Okay, today I want to speak about reader response criticism. There's a handout making its way around the class. Don't worry, if you don't have it right now, you won't really need it until towards the end of the lecture. What I want to do is talk about talk under three different kinds of headings. I want to talk about the what happens when you stop thinking of works of art as work and start thinking of them as text. There's a very famous essay by Roland Barthes called From Work to Text, and what I have to say is deriving largely from that essay. Secondly, I'll speak about a politics of reading, and then I want to give you some examples of some readers reading, and that's one of the things that's coming around on the handout that's making its way around. As before, I want to begin by giving a kind of background to this. It's a background that shows that reader response criticism is not something that is brand new, in fact. You could say that it has its origins, certainly in its contemporary version, it has its origins back in the 17th and 18th centuries. And it has its origins in the hands, I think, of Bishop Berkeley, whose name is on the handout that's coming around. Bishop Berkeley, living between 1685 and 1753. Bishop Berkeley was a philosopher who pondered the question of the existence of reality in relation to our perceptions of that reality. We know that there's a real world out there because we can perceive it. You can see it, smell it, touch it, taste it, and so on. Hear it. The famous apocryphal example that he gives is the example of the tree in the quadrangle of a college. We know there's a tree in front of us because we perceive it. Suppose, he says, there is nobody around to perceive it. Suppose the tree is not being perceived, not being seen, smelt, touched, tasted by anybody, heard even by anybody. In what sense, he says, can the tree be said to exist? Existence in many ways depends upon the priority of our perception of existence, is part of the logic of the argument. Does the tree disappear? Does it cease to exist if nobody's around looking at it? Well, Bishop Berkeley's answer to this was instructive. He denied that there was ever a moment when the tree was not being perceived. After all, he's a bishop, and therefore he says, God perceives it in all those moments when nobody else is around to perceive it. He concedes the possibility that there might be a tree there with nobody perceiving it. But he says, don't worry, the tree will remain in existence because God will perceive it. So the argument here is that things exist because of our ability to perceive them. That's how we have any kind of meaningful existence of objects in the world. Likewise with texts. Could a text be said to exist if nobody has ever read it, or if nobody will read it? Does a text exist then if it hasn't been read? Is it possible? Is it possible for a text not to have been read? In some ways, maybe you might think that its writer is always, in some sense, its first reader. Then, if you remember from the formalism essay way back in first term when I spoke about Bakhtin, you might believe that the writer of a text always already assumes a reader whose expectations the writer takes into account when she or he makes the text that you're about to read. So it might thus be said that in some ways it's the reader who is responsible for the shape, form, and even the existence of the text. The reader, in some ways, becomes the author of the text in the sense that the text depends upon the reader. And this opens up the issue for us, I think, quite nicely. What is the role of the reader in literary criticism? Some theories, as you know, have tried to relegate the reader to a purely residual and a kind of unimportant role. Remember the American New Criticism talking about the affective fallacy, where the reader's response, the reader's emotive response, was regarded as being somehow unimportant. Formalism likewise says, let's pay less heed to the reader and let's pay more attention to the form of the work in and of itself. Others, by contrast, have given the reader much greater importance, as you found in the case of I.A. Richards, and then when we talked a little bit about psychoanalysis, for example. What I want to do today is get towards 20th century versions and now more current versions of some readers who will read. And to get there, I want to do some work on how we shift our thinking from the words to the text. We all nowadays talk casually about literary text. We don't talk about books very much anymore. We talk about texts. We didn't always talk in that kind of way. We often talked about works of art, the work of Keats, the work of Shakespeare, the work of Shelley, the work of Milton, and so on. Nowadays, we casually talk about the text. But it took us a little while to get to that casual contemporary use. And I want to speak a little bit about what the kind of dominant ideology would be if we thought not of the stuff that you're reading as text, but as works. And let me put a thing in front of you here that might, a kind of symbol in front of you that might help to explain what I'm trying to get at here. If we think of something as a work, you think of it as something which has been completed. You think of it as something which is pretty solid, pretty monumental. You think of it in some ways rather like a statue. It's there, it's unchanging, it's for all time. It's kind of difficult to, in any way, get into. That's to say, it's external to your body, you perceive it as being external to your body, and it's solidly there. You can perceive it very, very clearly, and you perceive it as external to yourself. A text, by contrast, is something different from that. The word text comes to us from the notion of weaving. Think of the clothes that you're wearing. How were they put together? Well, they're put together by having a weave and a weft. They're put together by having some threads going up and down the way, like that, and other threads going in and out that way, crossways. That's what holds the thing together, and you call that the texture of your clothing. And depending on how you make it, it can be quite soft, it can be quite firm, depending on how closely you weave, and so on. And it will give you a different shape and a different colour, depending on how you do the weaving. But the important thing about that, as you know, is that if you rub it with your fingers, gradually you'll wear it down. And actually, it's quite easy, if you get something quite sharp, to insert something into it and make a little hole. Now imagine the thing in front of you that you're reading like this, like a woven thing with lines of poetry, for example, going that way from left to right, but at the same time the sense of the text depending on you reading down the page as well. When you're going down, you're remembering what went across. It used to be the case that we thought of this as something that would result in something monumental, like a sculpture, as I said. Now, when you think about a text, you think about something with spaces in between, something where something sharp, like your wit, your intellect, your critical ability and acumen, can insert itself and make little holes, make a little space for yourself. When you make a little hole, what you're doing is inserting yourself into the pullover, the shirt, or the text. And as Barthes will tell you, in many of his writings, there's something quite erotic about that. It's rather like getting your hands inside somebody's clothing. And it makes it much more interesting and much more engaging, says Barthes, than it would be just to stand back in a rather disengaged fashion and admire the solid monumentality of the suit of armour that you can't get your finger into. And I want to use that as the kind of governing presiding example here to explain what happens when you shift in your ideological thinking from thinking about works to thinking about text. Let's go back to the bad old days, as it were, when we used to think about works. When you thought about art as being something solid and monumental, when you thought about literature as being something solid and monumental that you would, as it were, regard from a distance and perceive from a distance, then certain key dominant ideological beliefs get established. First of these would be what you could call the priority of the world, in which the world is assumed to exist prior to any language that would describe that world. In that state of affairs, language is reduced to being a mere shadow or a reflection of something else much more important than the language itself. And when you subscribe to that particular kind of ideological belief, you start to produce statements in your criticism about how realistic the text is. You talk about how well the language of the text mirrors or reflects the prior reality. And you talk, therefore, about how realistic the text is. Secondly, when you think about works, you believe in the priority of experience. The prior reality that I've just spoken of is taken to be the quarry of criticism. Experience of reality, as opposed to the experience of a text, is seen to be the more important thing. And your textual experience, the experience of reading about something, is seen as a second-order kind of activity, something that is derivative of and something that is somehow less than an experience of reality. So the experience of love, for example, as a real thing that goes on in your life, is taken as being more important than the experience of reading about love. Okay, so the experience in the real world is taken to be primary. In our case, the experience of the author, therefore, the author who makes the text, who expresses herself or himself, is somehow supposed to be more important than your experience of reading about that particular experience. The experience of the author in this case is also somehow supposed to be very precise, very nice. When I say nice, I mean nice in the sense of being very precise. Hence, the necessity of that rather difficult and obscure language to reveal and convey the experience. When you believe this, then you get statements about how vivid the text is, because it gives you a sensation of, for example, the experience of love that is very lifelike. It's very vivid. It's as if you were there. It's a wee bit like, you know, when you listen to Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, and people blather on about actually, you know, hearing the animals in the field. That kind of stuff that you hear in the field. Well, if that's your sense of what Beethoven's about, then what you're doing is believing that, hey, Beethoven once stood in a field and heard the cows going meow and heard the sheep going meh meh and thought, I know, I can imitate that and give people who've never seen the countryside a little bit of it. And you sit at home, never having gone to the country, and you think, that's kind of vivid. It's that kind of stuff. You believe you're really there. When you're reading Sylvia Plath, you believe that you're really in the kitchen with the head in the oven with her. That kind of stuff. Okay? It's very vivid. You could feel it as if you were there. Smell the gas. Okay. Now, I'm using extreme examples to try to get the point across. Thirdly, we usually subscribe, if we believe in the idea of the work, we subscribe to an idea that the author is intent, through this work, on conveying an experience, that she or he has something that they want to communicate or to convey. The reader, therefore, is put in the position of one who passively receives a message. And this produces statements concerned with what we nowadays call the expressive realism of the text, and provokes judgments as to its accuracy. It accurately conveys some kind of prior meaning, some meaning that existed prior to the language in which it is expressed. All of this leads you to a belief in a kind of hierarchy in which the author controls her or his language and its meanings, and the reader, standing under, or as we usually put it, understanding the author, passively receives the meaning which the author put there. And that gives you a sense that the author is in some kind of elevated position with respect to the reader. And that's what you have come to understand as how literature works. The author, for some reason, won't reveal herself or himself very directly. And your task as a reader is to struggle with the words that the author puts there to get close to the author. Luckily, you've got somebody here called your teacher who will bridge the gap for you. But likewise, I won't tell you the answer either. So you get a hierarchy that goes author, beneath the author, critic, beneath the critic, student, beneath the student, common reader. You've moved yourself from being a common reader to being a student. Your next task is to become a critic, and then eventually you'll become like a poet, all being well. That's the kind of hierarchy. And you can see that there are very clear politics in that hierarchy. Finally, subscribing to all four of these beliefs, that's to say, belief in the priority of the world, the priority of experience, what you could call conveyancing or communication, and the hierarchy, you get to a fundamental belief in the unity of the text. If the meaning of a text is known to someone, the author, and recognisable to author and reader, then it must also be ipso facto univocal, one meaning, unambiguous. And that produces statements concerning the internal unity of things like the text itself, the internal unity of the poem. You typically will write a critique that says the poem is a unified thing. Even if I give you a text that's falling apart, like The Wasteland, a very, very fragmentary text, you will demonstrate that you've made your way up the hierarchy because, unlike the common reader, you're able to see the fundamental unity underlying all those fragments. These fragments I have shored against my ruin at the end of the poem, and you think, yes, I'm able to show, unlike the common reader, that there is a fundamental unity to this particular poem. And that unity is given to me because of the unity of the poet's intention. And it's underpinned by the unity of the meaning of the text, which gives me a sense of the unity of the author. T.S. Eliot was one person, even though I know that Ezra Pound actually helped write quite a lot of The Wasteland. And underlying that, then, the unity of the reader, me. I'm a unified person too. So we get a fundamental unity of five things: the poem, the intention, the meaning, the author, and finally, the reader. The dominant ideology, therefore, is one that subscribes eventually to an ideology of unified individuals, or what we usually call bourgeois individualism. So if you subscribe to the idea of the monumental work, the unchanging monumental work, then you, fundamentally, you're led into a politics that suggests that actually you are a bourgeois individualist, which is fine if you want to be that way, but actually reader response criticism will show that that is a fundamentally flawed way of thinking about how we engage in reading. So let me speak a little bit more now about a politics of reading. And in this, let me speak a little bit about the work of Roland Barthes, B-A-R-T-H-E-S. Barthes makes a fundamental distinction between two kinds of writing and two kinds of reader. We tend, let's say, to think of writing as being about something. That's to say, we tend to think of writing as being referential. It refers us to something non-linguistic. And we think of it as being instrumental, as a vehicle for something else, something that, as it were, instrumentally allows us to get to a message, or we think of it as being a kind of ornamental dress to language. Writing is a kind of ornamental dress to language, what oft was thought, but ne'er so well expressed, as Pope puts it. But although writing can operate like this, there is another kind of writing, says Barthes, and another kind of writer. And this second kind of writer has become much more prevalent, he says, since the beginning of the 20th century. This second group of writers understand the verb to write as an intransitive verb, he says. An intransitive verb is a verb that does not have an object. A transitive verb is something that has to have an object. Okay, let me think of a good example here. I opened the door. In that case, opens a transitive verb because it opens something. There's an object to the verb. If you say I opened, that doesn't really make much sense. It is a transitive verb because it needs an object. You need to be opening something. Okay? But, and you could say I write is also a transitive verb. I could write what? I write a story, I write a poem, I write a play, I write a letter, I write an email. But imagine a state of affairs in which you just said, I'm writing. And I said to you, what are you writing? And you say, well, I'm writing. At that moment, there is no actual object of the verb to write, except the verb to write. I'm writing that I'm writing. This idea of writing as an intransitive verb is something that Barthes says gives us a different kind of writing. For these writers who take the verb to write as an intransitive verb, the idea is not to pass through their writing to something else beyond it, but simply to write as such. And this latter kind of writer, whose aim is to produce what Barthes calls writing with a capital W, is what Barthes calls an écrivain. You've got it on your handout on the first sheet of the handout. The former kind he refers to as a scripteur or an écrivain. So while the scripteur always has an ulterior purpose in writing, the écrivain just writes. Their subject, if any, is the present activity of writing. It's a wee bit like, you know that great, great novel by Proust that if you haven't read, you should read? A la recherche du temps perdu. Monumental novel. Huge thing. In which the plot can be reduced to three words if you speak French. Marcel is a central character. Marcel devient écrivain. Four words if you speak English. Marcel becomes a writer. The central character, Marcel, spends 12 volumes getting to the point where he becomes able to write the text that you've just read, A la recherche du temps perdu. So when you get to that point, you're able to read the text for the first time. When you get to the end of A la recherche, you've got to read the whole thing again. It's a wee bit like some other modernist texts. And why? Because the fundamental story of A la recherche is how a writer becomes a writer. A bit like Wordsworth's Prelude, same kind of idea. In this state of affairs, then, you get that the two columns of oppositions that I've given you in the handout that's sitting in front of you. Two columns, which if I can find my own copy of the handout, I'll tell you about. On the one hand, you've got writing as a transitive activity, and that makes a text readable and consumable, because you're the passive recipient of the message. On the other hand, you've got writing as an intransitive activity, which makes the text writable and producible. It's a wee bit like moving from looking at a statue and passively receiving the image of the statue to that point where you stick your finger into the text and you start shaping the kind of holes that you want to make, and more importantly, you start shaping the kind of pattern that you want to make. And that kind of engagement with the text, and let's now call it a text because it's textured, that kind of engagement makes you responsible for producing what we now call the poem or the novel. You're not totally responsible for it because there was a jumper there, a pullover there, that you were able to get your fingers into in the first place. But in getting your fingers into the text, in, as it were, using the sharpness of your wit or your intellect to make an incision in the text, you're able to start producing the text. So the text produced in this way demands much more work on the part of the reader. The consumable text, says Barthes, gives something that he calls plaisir, a particular kind of pleasure. The producible text, with its difficulties, its fracturedness, its falling apartness, its messiness, gives instead what he calls jouissance. And those of you who speak French know the difference between plaisir and jouissance. Jouissance is a term which in French means something very close to orgasm. It's a kind of orgasmic activity and not just a pleasant activity. It's like the difference, I suppose, between being a voyeur on the one hand and being absolutely enmeshed in an activity on the other hand. This set of distinctions for Barthes eventually comes under an awful lot of pressure. In one of his greatest works, a work called SZ. S-Z. In SZ, he proposes a reading of a very simple story by Balzac. The story by Balzac is called Sarrasine. S-A-R-R-A-S-I-N. Sarrasine. Very simple, short story. And it looks like a very readable text, like a kind of monumental text. What he does, however, is to break it up into 561 units or sections. Every phrase he treats separately. And with every phrase, he's able to problematize the reading of the sentence in which the phrase comes up. This is him inserting himself into the body of the text, pausing at every comma, if you like, every comma, every semicolon, every full stop, every breath. He pauses, inserts himself, and makes a comment. When you look at it, the text then becomes not a monumental whole, but something that starts falling apart spectacularly. Something that for Barthes began as a readable text, a monument, becomes a text, a textual thing, something that he has inserted himself into, and that therefore begins to fall apart. And as it falls apart, two things happen. One, it stops making coherent sense, and two, it becomes infinitely more interesting than it was. At this moment, what you're getting is Roland Barthes as a reader making something that was a work become a text. And as he does so, he opens the text in a particular way that makes it stop have a unified sense and instead produces a multiplicity of possibilities. Instead of one text now, we have 561 in this one short story. And at the end of this process, the Sarrasin that we come out with is very different from the Sarrasin that Balzac wrote. It's a Sarrasin that has been produced partly by Balzac, because he gave Barthes all the original phrases, but it's clearly been produced likewise partly by Roland Barthes himself. What we're moving here towards is a politics that says we don't subscribe to the idea of all of us being individuals, unified in any kind of simple way. Rather, we are not a society of individuals. We're a society of people who are ourselves falling apart, contradictory. We are multiple. We're rather like the Walt Whitman who says, I contradict myself very well. I contradict myself. I contain multitudes," in which his identity is based upon the idea that he need not always be unified, saying the same thing, and consistent. It's a wee bit closer to the truth. Is it not the case that sometimes you change your minds about a poem? Is it not the case that when you're reading a poem, you're actually unsure of the meaning? And you're unsure of the meaning because you're holding two, three, maybe five contradictory possible readings of that text in your mind all at once. Well, says Barthes, if you're doing that, good. That is a good thing. Because essentially, it is opening the text to a multiplicity of possible readings. It's getting us away from that idea of a hierarchy where at the top, or near the top, there's the author, and down near the bottom, there is the common reader, okay? Just call her or her the commoner, okay? You're getting away from the idea of there being a hierarchy to something which is, and of course, if you've got a hierarchy like that, you know what's like lurking behind the author, don't you? Who made me? God made me. Why did God make me? God made me to know him, to love him, and to serve him. I was raised as a Catholic. So those of you who were raised as Catholics will recognise that kind of catechism. Behind the author is the monumentality of God, who underpins and underlines absolutely everything and makes everything unified, stable, unchanging, determined. Well, says Barthes, let's get rid of all of that and let's replace that hierarchy, that vertical hierarchy, with a horizon. We could call it a horizon of certain kinds of expectations, a horizon that includes all of us as potentially being on the same plane, on the same level, in the same world, on the same horizon in that respect. It's therefore a politics that is intrinsically much more democratic. It says that the meaning of a text is not something given and underpinned by one absent univocal power or force or authority that we all must admire and obey. It says instead of that, the text is what we're going to make of it. And given that we're all on the same horizon, on that same kind of horizontal plane, the world, which contains that horizon, is what we will make of it. I started off with Bishop Berkeley talking about perceptions of the world and moving from that to perceptions of the text. Now let's go the other way, to get to the politics of reading that I'm concerned with here. If it is the case that we've moved from a hierarchical view of the world to a horizontal view of the world, or a democratic view of the world, then what we're saying is the world is not there pre-existing us as something that exists prior to our existence and therefore unchangeable by us. On the contrary, we're saying the world, like the text, is what we will make of it. The meaning that we will give to the world depends now not upon some kind of God, but actually upon us. In all of our contradictoriness, in all of our multiple dialogues, in all of our disagreements with each other, and so on. And in that state of affairs, we're given a massive responsibility. A responsibility to, as it were, keep the world going, or, in literary critical terms, a responsibility to keep the text alive, to keep it, in a sense, as something living, to preserve it. But not to preserve it as something unchanging. To preserve it, if you like, as a field of activity in which other readers can now join us. It's open, pluralistic, multiple, as opposed to being singular. Okay, that's possibly the most important thing that's going to come out of this lecture. So is that clear with you? Are you with me on that? You're understanding what I'm doing with it? Hello? Are you out there? Yes? You can say it. You're reading the text. Join in. I'm giving you a text. Now show me that you understand what I'm saying. Interfere with it. Interrupt me. Tell me that I'm wrong. That's what reader response is about. You might not do it now because it's too embarrassing to do it in a public place, but when you go back and look at your notes on this, insofar as you've made a text, you too now have to, as it were, get your fingers into the text that you've written and make of it what you will. Now what I want to do is show you some examples of how others have done that, some readers reading. And I'll give you, I think, if I have time, as many as 4 separate modes of reading. First up, let's talk about Wolfgang Iser, I-S-E-R. Wolfgang Iser, who died 2 years ago now, has one major idea that shapes reader response criticism. It's the idea of the implied reader. The implied reader. Any text, he says, any statement implies 2 positions, at least. The position of the addressee, the person who's, as it were, making the statement, offering the text, and that of the addressee. The position of the addressee is a position from which it is possible to make the statement. That's all. It's a position from which it's possible to make the statement. So the statement, "It is a lovely day today," is a statement that it's possible to make from the position of an English speaker living on planet Earth, coming in from the world outside here today where it was rather sunny. Here's another statement. That's a statement that it's possible for a Martian to make. And I know because I've spoken to them. Now that position here, it doesn't mean to say you need to know Martian. All you're doing is trying to understand that there is a position from which it makes sense to say, that's all you need to know. You don't need to know what it means. You just accept it as a language. Okay? In exactly the same way as you accept, even though you might not understand. You might not understand that. It might come to you, if you don't speak French, just as a kind of meaningless noise, almost as meaningless as... But you know that there is a position from which it makes sense to say. It's called Marseille, or it's called Paris. The addressee is a position, likewise, from which the statement can be understood. So addresser and addressee are not particular individuals, they're just positions. And as positions, they are mobile and changeable. I can understand I'm in a position that can understand both "it's a lovely day today" and "qu'est-ce qu'il fait beau aujourd'hui," because I speak 2 languages. Okay, if you only speak 1 language, then you're in a different position from me. That's all it means. Okay? So you've got those 2 positions. Let's call the addressee, for the purpose of this argument, a reader. The reader, for Wolfgang Iser, has her or his position manipulated by the text,
by the activity of reading or engaging with the text.
The reader, for Ezel, acts in accordance with the text to produce its meaning. Every text, he says, and go back to the example, the way that I described this at the beginning, thinking of text as texture, as a weaving, in that kind of way. Every text, he says, contains gaps. Imagine the description of a character. You cannot describe a character in her or his entirety in any text. It would simply be impossible. What did Madame Bovary's skin feel like? What did her liver look like? What did her liver look like after she had a glass of wine? How big was her heart? Clearly, a novel's not going to give you everything. They're going to give you important stuff, and you're going to fill in the gaps to make a meaningful entity. But gaps for Wolfgang Ezel are slightly more complicated than this. Take a look at the handout that I've distributed. On the second sheet of the handout, if I can again find my own copy, you've got a passage describing the reader's role in Joseph Andrews and Tom Jones. What he says here, in the page just before what I've given you, is that Fielding gives you various schemata, as he calls it, various frameworks, if you like, on which you can hang your sense of the character. Okay? But he says that they're conflicting. Take it from about four lines down. Through the conflict of schemata, the character takes on a definite individuality. At times approaching caricature, and always full of potential surprises for the reader. Caricature depends for its effect on distortion, but distortion in turn depends for its effect on our conception of what is normal. So we have a conception of what is normal, and we're seeing something in front of us that's not quite normal. It might be caricature, it might be distortion. Otherwise, he says, if we don't know what's normal, how would we know that something was being distorted? In the case of Parson Adams, the unshakable faith of Abraham is blended with the human weakness of Adam. Adam's pragmatic difficulties with Abraham's abstract resolution. These features, he says, are emphasised to the point of caricature, but it is for us to decide what the normal picture should look like. At the same time, it's the very oddness of the picture presented that surprises us, and this unexpected stimulates those reactions that bring the character to life. This bringing to life, however, is not an end in itself. It has the function of involving the reader in an action, the meaning of which he must discover for himself. The character is not aware of the conflicting schemata within himself, and the results of this ignorance are apparent right through the novel. Parson Adams, not knowing what he is, takes part in a variety of confrontations with the world, always reacting quite spontaneously and nearly always reacting inappropriately. The reader, though, is in the picture. Not only is he aware of Adams's popularity, but also, thanks to the author's numerous directions, he's aware of how inadequately Adams applies his ideal qualities in dealing with the world. Now, what does the reader do with this knowledge? The episodes in the novel often become a test for the reader's own capabilities. He sees the world through the eyes of the hero, and the hero through the eyes of a pragmatic world, and the result is conflicting views linked only by their completely negative nature. Jump now, because I'm running short of time here, to the next page. The narrative itself has distinctly negative features, although one cannot go so far as to say that the text actually proclaims the sordidness of the world or the stupidity of virtue. The over-precision with which the two negative poles have been presented inevitably adumbrates the positive features that are not formulated in the text. So by giving you a negative picture of the world, he implies a positive view, but he doesn't state it. That's the gap in the text, the positive view that is not stated, okay, in the world. The form, then, of this unwritten text becomes apparent to the reader as he reads. And so he begins to uncover what we might call the virtual dimension of the text. Virtual, as it's not described in the text, a dimension, insofar as it balances, even if it cannot reconcile the two conflicting, mutually negating poles. The virtual dimension is brought about through our forming the gestalt of the text, the wholeness of the text. But the wholeness of the text depends upon us realising that that which we have been given is a wee bit like a raggedy jumper. Okay, if I give you a ragged jumper, something where the bottom half is falling apart and not quite all there with holes in it, you can fill the gaps. But in filling the gaps, you're aware of what you're doing and you're aware of the fact that in order to construct a normal jumper, you've got to do certain kinds of things. And then you ask yourself, what's normal? Is it a jumper that has sleeves? Well, is it short sleeves, mid sleeves, long sleeves? Is it a jumper that has a V-neck? Is it a jumper that... And so you're engaged, as it were, making the shape of the text through forming a particular kind of gestalt here. So for Wolfgang Iserl, the act of reading is one that depends upon your ability to move between the text and, quotes unquote, what is normal. But importantly, you are also creating what you're thinking of as normal. So you're creating your own norms for the world. And you're making a kind of perceptual gestalt, a perceptual whole from a text that is of necessity fragmentary. Let's move on to the case of Stanley Fish. Stanley Fish, the key term for Stanley Fish, especially in his early work, is surprise. Literature, says Fish, is not something that means. It doesn't mean something, it does something. And what it does is to do things to the reader, making the reader go through particular kinds of activity and through particular kinds of motion. He reads, and if you go back to your handout here, you'll find it in a passage from Self-Consuming Artifacts. He reads a little bit from a sermon by John Donne. You got it at the top of the page. And therefore, as the mysteries of our religion are not the objects of our reason, but by faith we rest on God's decree and purpose, so, O God, because it is thy will, it should be so, so God's decrees are ever to be considered in the manifestation thereof. Little passage from a sermon by John Donne. Now Fish analyses it. And the way he analyses it is, rather like Barthes, taking it a step at a time. The opening of the sentence, he says, bears two interrelated promises. Its point will be made discursively, and the making of the point will take the form of a demonstrative argument, thesis and proposition, followed by a conclusion. You get all that from the word therefore. And therefore, as soon as I say to you, and therefore, you know that I'm going to make a discursive argument. For a time, he says, these promises are kept. And because they are kept, the reader is involved in the very activity that the sentence is warning against. The mysteries of our religion are not the objects of our reason, we are told. And yet, the simple act of taking in the words, and therefore, involves us unavoidably in reasoning about the mysteries of religion. In the logic of the experience, as opposed to the logic of the syntax, the weakest word in the first three clauses is not. For as we negotiate the sentence, its meaning is less pressing, literally, than the machinery that is supposedly processing it. And although we read and understand the words, the thrust of our attention is forward, in the direction of the waiting so, which will complete the sequence begun by, and therefore as. You know, when I give you a sentence that begins, and therefore as, you're waiting for me to say, so it follows that. Okay? Now look what happens. But when the so is reached, he says, twice in a parenthesis, and he puts that in a parenthesis himself, being very witty, when that so is reached, twice in a parenthesis, it does not complete, but disrupts the sentence, for it's the wrong so. It is so, O God, because it's thy will it should be so. This is the so of divine fiat, a causality more final than any that could be observed, and so on. In the rest of this sequence, you see that what's happening is that, according to Fish, the text is manipulating the reader in ways that are actually forcing you into contradictory positions. But every time you get yourself into a contradictory position, your task is to normalise it, to stop contradicting yourself. Every time you do that, says Fish, you're going to be surprised by the next move in the poem or the text that you're reading. As with this example, he says, so with literature. That's what it does to you. It constantly sets up an expectation that it will then not quite fulfill, and therefore surprises you all the time. It does things to you in that kind of way. And in surprising you, what's happening is that you're constantly modifying your sense of what the text means. And in constantly modifying your sense of what the text means, you're constantly also modifying your idea of what makes sense in the world. You're therefore constantly modifying yourself. The process of reading here is one that involves the reader in making up ends, projected ends for sentences,
or from narratives, and then changing them. And that process of changing your mind is itself the meaning of the text. The text, the meaning of the text, if you will, is how it makes you change your mind in various ways. Let me give you a mad example. Example of David Blyth, who's also given out to you on the handout. David Blyth takes reader response to what seems to be a kind of logical extreme, the extreme of subjectivism. Blyth, like these other people, says that we should interrupt our reading. But for Blyth, we interrupt our reading in order to do what reading's about, to explore the meaning of yourself, he says. That's what he says. What we do, he says, is to make free associations with the text and its fragments in order to allow us to come to a greater degree of self-knowledge. The example that he gives here, which I'll leave you to read yourself, is an example taken from Lady Chatterley's Lovel. And what he does is to explain how his student responded to this particular passage. One of the students reading the passage takes the moment in Lady Chatterley's Lovel where Connie and Michaelis are making love. Connie is on top of Michaelis in this particular episode, and Michaelis quite quickly has an orgasm. But Connie hasn't had her orgasm yet, and she's kind of impatient. So instead of stopping and thinking that was a bit of a disappointment, she keeps on going on top of Michaelis. And the student reading this text, Blyth's student, stops at that point and starts thinking, as you would imagine, starts thinking about what's going on in the text and freely associates with it. And what she says is, it kind of reminds her a little bit of when she was a child, her father saying that you should always squeeze the toothpaste tube from the bottom end of the tube, because otherwise it's a bit of a waste. And she says, Connie eking out her pleasure is a wee bit like her father encouraging her to eke out the last bit of toothpaste from the toothpaste tube. Now, if you write that in your essay for me on Lady Chatterley's Lover, I'm likely to think, why are you telling me this? But if you're in David Blyth's class, you're telling me this because, for David Blyth, actually you're engaged in a process of coming to a self-knowledge. You're interrupting your reading of the text in order to find out something more about yourself. And by now meditating a little bit on your relation between you and your father and a toothpaste tube, then you can get to some sense about what you think of as pleasure, what you think of the economy of sex, what you think of the economy of sexual pleasure, and how it relates to various moments of oral gratification, oral hygiene, and so on. I will move on from that before we start getting into areas that we shouldn't get into. But the point here is this is a very different kind of subjective reader response criticism, where you've moved away from the text and into the realms of the self. Okay, that is another mode of reader response criticism. The final example I want to give you is an example. I haven't given you an example of this in the handout. It's an example from, again, from German philosophy, Hans-Robert Jauss. Hans-Robert Jauss, J-A-U-S-S. What Jauss did was to say that we could get to fundamental activities of engaging and understanding a text by looking at, not the text, but how the text has been read historically. So, for example, he will take a play by Molière, let's say, a late 17th century French play. And he will read the text, certainly, but more importantly than that, he will also read the criticisms of the text that were produced in France in the early 18th century, then the mid-18th century, then the 19th century, and so on. And by looking at the various ways in which the texts have been received, he's able to come up with what he calls an aesthetics of reception. He's able to analyse the literary reception of this particular text, which will tell you something about the text, certainly, will tell you a great deal about the historical moments in which the text was produced, and will allow you to compare late 17th century France with, for example, late 20th century England, where you also saw the play and it was critiqued in, I don't know, The Guardian or something. What he will do is then find a way of talking about, if you like, the history of cultures through
the history of texts, and more importantly, the history of the ways in which we have received those texts. The important thing in all of this is the reader has become much more central, and you get what Yaus would think of as a kind of horizon of the possible ways in which texts can make sense, as well as a historical chronology of how the text has made sense. In all of these moves, we're moving away from the hierarchical sense of an author being central. You're not getting rid of the author totally, clearly. You still need authors to be giving you the raw materials. But you as a reader are engaged more fully in the production of the text, and being engaged in the production of the text and meaning, you also now have a massive aesthetic responsibility, a moral responsibility, and even, let me say it finally, a political responsibility or an answerability for your readings. You have to answer for the readings that you will make in the text. What I want to do in the next couple of weeks is to take you back to show you that the kinds of theory that we've been talking about for the last, whatever it is, 14 weeks or so, is not something entirely new. There's a kind of prehistory of all of this, and it starts in the ancient world. So next week, I'm going to take you back to Plato and do a little bit of work with you on Plato and the origins of our literary and cultural theories. Thanks for your attention today. Good luck.